We come here from many places, seeking many things. Some come for the company or the stimulation. Some bring unspoken joys or pains that need the closeness of others. But beneath it all, we come in the hope that here, somehow, we may catch a glimpse and a feel of something enduring, something stable, something which can support and nourish us, coax and guide us toward a better life and a better world. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
Do or fail to do. We're making memories and writing the story of our lives.
Too often the fantasy and the reality of our lives are our world apart. Sometimes we can't find our way or can't recognize the way when we've found it. Sometimes we're confused and our vision is clouded. Sometimes it seems that the cost of taking the high road is too high, and so we take the lower road because we believe it is all we can really afford. Let us take this time, this place, these moments to remind ourselves of our higher calling. Let us be open to hearing the voices of gods rather than idols, entertaining those angels of our better nature rather than the little demons and goblins of our lesser selves. Let us think and act in ways that can do honor to us and to those who love us. For we are the gatekeepers of our better tomorrows. We are all of us, brothers and sisters, children of God, and the best hope of a more compassionate world. Let us act as though God were watching, as though those whom we love were watching, as though all the great and noble souls of history were watching. Let us live in such a way that when we are finished, we can say, in my time here, I was as compassionate and courageous as I knew how to be. In my time, I was, if even only in my small way, a blessing to those whose lives I touched. I came, I cared, and in the most important matters, I tried to be authentic. I wasn't perfect, but I was the best person I knew how to be, and that is enough. It is enough. Amen.
The theme for this sermon came to me from two different stories. One was recent. It happened about a dozen years ago in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was visiting friends, and they wanted to take us out to dinner to a restaurant they'd never been to before, a spectacular restaurant. And so we all piled in their van, and Don was driving. After about 15 minutes, it was clear that Don didn't know where the restaurant was and didn't have much of an idea where we were either. And his wife started kidding him, saying, "Oh, this is just great. We invite company over. We try to be hosts, make it an impressive evening, and all we can do is get hopelessly lost in the back streets of Milwaukee." Don wasn't fazed. He said, "Nah," he said, as we turned onto another dark, bleak street. "Nah," he said, "we're not getting lost. We're making memories." I look back and I see he was right. I don't remember the dinner at all. But I'll never forget driving around the streets of Milwaukee laughing every time we took another dumb turn in the half an hour it took us in the wilderness before we finally found the completely unmemorable restaurant. And I think sometimes if we could just reframe
the times we make mistakes into times we were making memories, we'd be under a lot less stress, especially if we could convince our bosses to go along with us. The second story about making memories is much older and a little classier. It comes from the book of Joshua in the Bible, and it's the story of the time after wandering through the desert for 40 years when the 12 tribes finally crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land. This was the milk of honey, the paradise they'd been looking for 4 decades. I'm sure that both I and my friend Don are descendants of one of these tribes. The story of crossing over into the Promised Land is a funny story. It was written around 500 or so B.C. when the Hebrew people were in captivity in Babylonia. They were in their Babylonian captivity. And the story was made up about events that happened, if they happened at all. And many scholars don't think there ever was a time when the Hebrew people were in Egypt. But if they happened at all, the events happened 600 or 800 years earlier than that. So this is mythology, not history, not an eyewitness account. Both times when they crossed over the Red Sea to get into the wilderness and when they crossed over the Jordan River to get into the Promised Land, they're both variations on the same story. Both times, one of the interesting things about it is that the people didn't want to go. During their first few years in the wilderness, all they did was whine at Moses, wishing he would take them back to Egypt so they could be slaves again, in a situation that was familiar to them. As Shakespeare said, we would rather bear those ills we know than fly to others that we know not of. You don't have to be an ancient Jew to feel this. It's almost disheartening how often we will refuse to change our situation or our strategy, even when it's painfully obvious that it's not working, like Don driving around the streets of Milwaukee. There are billions of examples. I invite you to come up with some from your own life, as unpleasant as they may be, but I'll remind you of some others. Many of you know the story, on a very dramatic, large scale, the story of the Battle of Gallipoli in the First World War, or some of you have seen the Australian movie of that name. Thousands upon thousands of men climbing out of their foxholes, obeying orders to march into machine gun fire, dying in piles, and climbing over the piles of dead men to die in their turn. Tens of thousands of people dying in one day. Surely one of the stupidest single days in the history of warfare. You can see it a lot closer to home, too, though it's just as heartrending. If you know anything about battered women's shelters or people who work in them, to the frustration of everyone else, women who are battered usually return to the home where they'll be beaten again, because they prefer the suffering they know to the fear of what might happen if they leave. It's also what makes it hard for so many people to leave an old religion that seems to own their soul, even though it's not feeding them. We seem to be an easy species to manipulate. We're slow to leave old habits and ruts. But back to the story of the people crossing the Jordan River to get to the Promised Land. When they finally reach the river, it's dangerous. The priests of the 12 tribes go first. They've been told that if they have the courage to step into the rushing waters, the water will miraculously stop so that they can cross over. And in the story, obviously a story written by priests, the priests go first and step into the river, and sure enough, since they're writing the story, the river stops. And the people can cross. And then as they cross over comes what I think the wonderful, the magical point of the story is. As they cross over the river, they stop and they pick up big rocks from the bottom of the river where they've had the courage to cross over. And when they get to the other side, they take these big rocks and they pile them up to make a monument. They stopped to make a memory. Because a miracle had happened. And it would be a terrible thing if we let miracles go by without making memories. It would be so terrible if we were ever to forget that they can really happen to us, these miracles. So they make a memory from the rocks that marked the place where they showed the faith and the courage to cross over a significant boundary. The psychological insights of this old story are as modern as anything could be. But in real life, I think it's hardly ever the priests who lead us. I say this as one. I've gone to one of the locked shelters for battered women, and I've asked the women what advice they get from their pastors when they go to them for help. And any of you who've worked with them know what the answer is going to be to this. Many have said their ministers told them God wanted them to go back home to be their husband's helpmates. I've spoken with some of the women who worked on the locked floors of a YWCA where battered women could seek refuge, and they've told me that the most astonishing calls they get are from the pastors of the battering husbands, ministers who tell them that they are to release these women to go home where they belong. Far too often, priests don't help people choose life. And I'm not going to get into the obvious examples of this that have been in the paper for a year and a half about all the Catholic priests and the misleading that has gone on in that church. It's a church struggling mightily with a very serious problem. Far too often, other leaders don't lead either. Political leaders don't lead us to more life. Far too often, the print, the radio, and the television media don't have the courage or the freedom to run the most important and revealing stories, and so they offer car crash journalism, sensationalist programs to draw crowds to please sponsors, a kidnapper, a sniper shooting, a plane crash, stories that draw crowds but don't educate or enlighten them. Those who should lead too often mislead. Most of the time, those who are the first willing to cross over dangerous boundaries are ordinary people. Think of the police and the firefighters on September 11th, a year ago. Most often, those who lead the way are regular people who found the courage of their convictions and stood firm. What's this mean in your everyday life? To me, it means a lot of things. You have a friend who's involved in a relationship where they're being abused, psychologically abused, emotionally abused, physically abused, or all of the above. And what do? I think if you care about them, you do what you can to help them see where they are and how to get out of it. Every day set before us are life and death, and we're always commanded to choose life, and we're commanded to choose it for our friends too. You tell them there's another way to live, that they don't have to stay in a relationship that beats their body and drains their soul. Or you have a friend who's enslaved by an unhealthy religion of whatever flavor. They wish they could leave it, but they're scared to go because it's got a hold of their soul, even though it can't feed them and they're starving to death. Or you know someone with no religion and an emptiness in them that needs an honest style of religion for both head and heart. You can say, I know a church you might like. I know somewhere where you can be uplifted rather than put down, where you can find inspiration without intimidation. Why don't you come to church with me this Sunday? Now, all that's down-to-earth, ordinary life, regular stuff. But there's another level to this old Bible story that I never thought of until this week. One of the things I love about great myths, magnificent fictions, is that the more you get into them, the more doors they open and the more things there are to find in them. And this is something I'd never thought of about this story until this week, even though it's one of the most obvious things in the story. And that's the difference between leading and just posturing. The priests in the story, since they wrote the story,
The priests were leaders. And the way you can tell that is because people followed them. But as any of us who have been involved in many political rallies or religious shenanigans know, especially now over this looming war, a lot of the time the positions are stated with a kind of self-righteousness, and it seems like the people are just posturing, wanting you to think of them as virtuous, not trying to communicate with people who see things differently and not leading. That's wrong. A colleague in Michigan, if we're going to make fun of people, we need to make fun of our own people here. A colleague in Michigan wrote me about a march against the war a couple weeks ago in some location that will be kept secret to protect the guilty. The sign that stopped him cold was one carried by members of a local Unitarian church. What the sign said was, "You use for social interaction." What? What on earth does this mean? You use for social interaction. Is the idea that if we'll play together, everything will just be swell? It's not leadership. Another story, same plot, comes from San Francisco, where a huge herd or gaggle or whatever the collective noun is, a huge gaggle of 400 costumed clergy gathered on the Golden Gate Bridge a couple weeks ago. They wanted to protest the war, so what they did was put on their costumes and stand on the bridge holding hands. That's it. And they wondered why, even though some media were there, nobody aired it. And I'm thinking, what would they air? What's the story here? 400 clergy gathered to be seen in costume holding hands? There's a war looming with a lot of very specific and important issues and arguments and facts that need to be confronted and learned and engaged with dialogue that has to happen between people who don't see things the same way. That's leadership. Standing on a bridge in a costume, holding hands, trying to look virtuous. It's posing. And it's embarrassing. Now, I'm not saying leading is easy. The more I try to get involved in these things, the more I learn how hard it is and how bad I am at it and how much I still have to learn. I spent most of yesterday from 2 o'clock till after 7:30 at a six-hour about program of speeches and panel discussions on the prospect of war in Iraq. It was up at Gethsemane Lutheran Church up north of here. The high points of the day came early, as some of you probably saw who were there. Our Congressman Lloyd Doggett and a community activist named Bert Sachs, who I think is from the Seattle area, both said that it's a waste of time and energy to spend time preaching to the converted. That we have to try to communicate with people who don't agree with us. One of them said that those who want to prevent or stop this war may not demonize anyone. Now, those comments didn't get clapped and cheered for the way all their others did. But they were the most important comments of the day. I know they're right, but it's hard to remember it, and I have taken my turns demonizing people too, and it's wrong. Now, after those wonderful, uplifting words, I participated in one panel discussion, and I listened to another, and it seemed to me that most of the speakers were posing rather than leading. It seemed to me that they felt morally superior to those who want war, and had no strong interest in communicating with them. That's not leading. That's posturing. Nobody's following except the herd that already thinks like we do. It's a waste of spirit. We can't afford it. Now, after that rant,
There's still another lesson in this old story that's never mentioned, but it's always there behind the scenes, and now it feels very important to me too. When war is in the air, ministers' jobs get more complex. It's very seductive to want to go dress up and pose and feel virtuous. It is very seductive to just go feel special and hold hands. I think it's a horrible waste of spirit, but it's very seductive. And what we have to remember that's going on in every story of war, every story of wandering through the wilderness or crossing over, is the fact that while these dramatic things are going on, life goes on. There is still joy, love, tender moments. People still fall in love and get married. Babies are still born. We've had 2 babies born in this church community in the past week. There are still important jobs to do as mothers and fathers and people of faith and citizens. Life still goes on. Personally, I have to try to speak out in Austin against what I believe is the foolishness and the deception of this proposed war. And I will struggle to learn how to lead rather than just posturing, and it's hard to do. But the war will not be our primary focus here, even though the experience of war will be the focus of the Veterans Day service in 2 weeks. But the war will not be the primary focus here in church. My primary focus and our ministerial intern Kathy's primary focus will remain on you and your lives and the life of the church. This morning I needed to remind myself that in everything we do or fail to do, like it or not, we're making memories and writing the story of our lives. Maybe you needed reminding too. So the prayer I have to offer is for myself, for you, for our political and religious leaders, for all of us. Let us remind ourselves of our higher calling. Let us be open to hearing the voices of gods rather than idols, entertaining those angels of our better nature rather than the little demons and goblins of our lesser selves. Let us think and act in ways that can do honor to us and to those who love us, for we are the gatekeepers of our better tomorrows. We are all of us brothers and sisters, children of God, and the best hope of a more compassionate world. Let us act as though God were watching, as though those whom we love were watching, as though all the great and noble spirits of history were watching. And let us live in such a way that when we are finished, we can say, in my time here, I was as compassionate, as courageous as I knew how to be. In my time, I was, if only in my small way, a blessing to those whose lives I touched. I came, I cared, and in the most important matters, I tried to be authentic. I wasn't perfect, but I was the best person I knew how to be. And that is enough. It's enough. Amen.